of, say, physical force or a military attack or something like that, but it reflects the fear that is there inherent in the fragility of their egos, of the leadership's ego. And so they can't deal with any sort of criticism. And this is sort of a real common phenomenon with dictatorships across the world.
While Twitter has not revealed the identities of individuals who were possibly exposed in the infiltration, the connection between Savan's arrest and the alleged breach in 2014 was first reported last year by Bloomberg. In addition to Savan, human rights organizations said they have identified six Saudi citizens who've been arrested in connection with anonymous Twitter accounts they ran. This is Arij Al-Savan on her brother's case.
My brother, unfortunately, was one of those targeted by the Twitter spies, or rather, you know, by the Saudi officials. Basically, he had an anonymous Twitter account, like many other Saudi people, and he was expressing his opinion. He was criticizing, you know, issues related to social justice, human rights. He wasn't actually that heavy in terms of his activism or even criticism. He didn't really have much interest in politics. But it was more of a personal expression. He just liked to express his opinion. And, you know, when you're actually following Twitter, especially in Saudi Arabia, it's easy for you to feel like, you know, you can't stay silent and you want to talk, you want to express. And it's something normal. It's a normal, human aspect.
Omar Abdulaziz, a Saudi dissident living in Canada and a friend of the slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi, said in an exclusive interview to The Guardian that the FBI showed him a number of exposed accounts following the breach, including an account used by Savan. When I met the FBI, they gave me a list, and I saw a couple of accounts that had been compromised, including @Sama17. I think more than one person has been jailed because of this. @Sama70 is the parody account Savan used to run.
The internet has become an alternate battleground, essentially, both for governments and for their oppositions. And so it's quite possible that the Saudis have the technological capacity to go in and survey the various elements within the internet, looking for people who might express, you know, opposition in words or in pictures.
Abdulrahman Al-Savan's stiff sentence came after a long period of disappearance. His family didn't hear from him for 23 months. When his father saw him for the first time, Abdulrahman's health had deteriorated after months of being held in solitary confinement. Critics say enforced disappearance is a stock in trade of Riyadh when treating its opponents, a crime out of control.
If you look at what happened to Khashoggi, all right, the journalist, and now with Saddam, it seems quite clear that their thuggery, if you will, is quite open, because they don't think that there's anybody out there who can hold them responsible. And so I wouldn't give them the honor of calling them a government, actually. They're a dictatorship, and they rule by force, and their leadership is insecure in that position, and so they overreact to criticism.
The arrest of Savan is part of a larger attempt by the Crown Prince to establish its foothold in Saudi Arabia as the next king. The crackdowns have seen Saudi authorities arrest senior royals, activists, intellectuals, and clerics. Strangely enough, as a political satirist, Al-Sudan was tried in the so-called counterterrorism court. A clear message to those who turn their pens against the Saudi establishment. In fact, Mohammed bin Salman has over and over again proved that writing against the government is a crime that carries an automatic life sentence or so. Sudan's family say he faced a secret trial at the same court that had initially sentenced women's rights activists Loujain Al-Hathloul to nearly 6 years in prison. Shortly after the trial, MENA Rights Group tweeted, "We're appalled to learn that Abdurrahman Al-Sudan was sentenced to 20 years in prison and a 20-year travel ban after a sham trial before the Saudi Specialized Criminal Court. He has been detained arbitrarily for over 3 years and deprived of his own basic rights."
They're saying, look, we are your masters, and so you don't mess with us, because we will destroy you, and we will even destroy your reputation within Saudi culture or the Saudi population. Because we can label you a terrorist. Doesn't matter the victim matching up with any normal definition. We would just arbitrarily call you a terrorist, and you will go down in history as we tell you to go down. I mean, as we describe you. And so it's a warning, if you will, to others not to do this.
Al-Sudan's case is significant in another aspect. The heavy sentence came just as the Biden administration criticized Saudi Arabia for its poor human rights record. It shows that the Saudi de facto leader does not care much about what the world might think of his violations of human rights. And that the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi was not just an accident, but the tip of the iceberg.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, take care to provide well for your future abode. Do not barter away eternal blessing for pleasures of this mortal and fleeting world. Do not talk about things which you do not know. Do not speculate about and pass verdicts on subjects about which you are not in a position to form an opinion and are not called upon to do so. Give up the way where there is a possibility of your going astray. When there is danger on your wandering in the wilderness of ignorance, possibility of losing the sight of the goal which you want to attain and of reaching the end aimed at, then it is better to give up the quest than to advance facing uncertain dangers and unforeseen risks. Advise people to do good and live virtuously because you are fit to give such advice. Let your words and deeds teach the world lessons of how to abstain from wickedness and vicious deeds. Try your best to keep away from those who indulge in vices and sins. Fight whenever required to defend the cause of Allah. When you think of defending the cause of Allah, do not be afraid that people will laugh at you, censure your action, or slander you. Fearlessly and boldly help truth and justice. Bear patiently the sufferings and face bravely the obstacles which come in your way when you follow truth and when you try to uphold it. Adhere to the cause of truth and justice wherever you find it. Try to be well-versed with Islamic jurisprudence and theology and acquire a thorough knowledge of the canons of this religion.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. One of the great lessons, dear friends, which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali is this idea of living a simple lifestyle, having simple things in our lives, eating simple food, and living within our means, living a life away and far from extravagance, and furthermore living a life of humbleness and simplicity. And so along these lines, we find in the historical texts that one day Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, went to the market and bought a shirt for 3 dirhams, or 3 coins, and he then wore it. Now, interestingly, the sleeves of the shirt was not long enough to cover his wrists completely, and the shirt itself wasn't long enough to cover the legs completely. But despite this relatively seemingly downfall or fault of the shirt, Imam Ali raised his hands in prayer while wearing this same shirt and said, "O Lord, thank you for blessing me with a shirt which both covers my body and gives me splendor among the people." Subhanallah, glory be to Allah. We find here truly Imam Ali led such a simple life. He led such a humble life that his shirt was not long enough to cover his wrists. Now, at that time, to wear a shirt which covered your wrists or was long enough to cover all of your legs and perhaps even drag on the ground was considered to be the clothing of the elite. And so here we find that Imam Ali is not wearing the clothing of the elite, rather he is wearing the clothing of the disenfranchised. And despite this, he does not despair or become sad. On the contrary, he thanks Allah for blessing him with a shirt and giving him honor and splendor among the people. Truly, a very profound lesson which we learn here, that a simple life, a humble life, which is hand in hand with contentment and satisfaction, is a much better and happier life than an extravagant one. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالمون يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger. And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. For protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
The fasting of the month of Ramadan is an important pillar of our faith. And all physically fit and mature Muslims are required to fast every day of this month of Ramadan. Fasting is not unique to Islam. It is there in Christianity, in Judaism, even in Hindu and Buddhist tradition. There is this tradition of fasting. However, in Islam, when we talk about fasting, it is more involved in a sense that every day of the month of Ramadan, we have to abstain from dawn to dusk, abstaining from food, even from drinking water, and those who are smokers are not allowed to smoke. On spiritual level, we consider this an opportunity actually to strengthen our willpower. Because the whole exercise of fasting means that we deal with a challenge which goes on within us. We have our soul or conscious on one hand, the emotions and physical desires on the other hand. By midday, we start feeling hungry and thirsty. But even though food is there, water is available, even if we are alone, we abstain. And this is where you see there is an inner tension. The body is asking food and drink. But your mind, your soul and conscience says, I'm not going to eat and drink. And that's where we see that the willpower becomes more. And when we have a stronger willpower, it will help us on a spiritual level when we deal with temptations which come along the way. And this is a struggle that every human being goes through, irrespective of their religion or creed or their race. And so the month of Ramadan is actually a very important spiritual training, that when we come out at the end of the month with a stronger willpower, and when temptations come along the way, we are able to resist it more easily. And therefore, Islam does not only talk about fasting during the month of Ramadan. In the month of Ramadan, it is mandatory for every Muslim who is physically fit and mature to fast. But even besides the month of Ramadan, there are certain days in every month of the Islamic calendar where it is recommended to do the fasting so that we can continue this process of training ourselves spiritually.
Dear Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A comparison of the number of doses of vaccines manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. We now present you a two-part article written by Prabir Purkayastha, the founding editor of Newsclick.in, a digital media platform. The piece is titled, The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level. More than an eighth of the world's population living in rich countries, the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the European Union have access to more than 50% of the world's COVID-19 vaccine doses. According to Our World in Data, about 112 million people in the United States alone received at least a single inoculation by 8th of April. This is more than 12 times the total number of people vaccinated in the entire continent of Africa, which has four times the population of the United States. On 8th of April, the World Health Organization, WHO, said that nearly 13 million of the 31.6 million doses delivered so far to 45 African countries have been administered. And if we do not count the vaccine doses that have been administered in Morocco, truly an outlier in Africa, as of 8th of April, the United States has received almost 35 times the vaccine doses that Africa has. No wonder Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization's Director General, called the distribution of vaccines grotesque and a catastrophic moral failure. Let us not call reserving the bulk of vaccines for a handful of rich ex-colonial or settler colonial states vaccine nationalism. Let us call it what it is, vaccine apartheid at a global level. How much of the COVID-19 vaccine manufactured in the rich countries has gone to the rest of the world? The answer is that the rich countries have kept their supplies almost entirely to themselves. Moderna's vaccine production has mostly been used to inoculate the population in the United States, besides supplying it to some countries in Europe and also to Canada. Pfizer has supplied its vaccines to the United States from its US facilities, and to Europe and to the United Kingdom from its European plants. It has also supplied vaccines to the occupied Palestine and the Persian Gulf monarchies, and begrudgingly parts of Latin America, but that makes up a small fraction of its total production. The rich countries have had some squabbles with one another over vaccine supplies. An example of this is the clash between the European Union and the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca and the United Kingdom. Perhaps this is why they have had no time to think about the rest of the world. A comparison of the number of doses manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. Where has the rest of the world gotten its vaccines from? It appears that the only other sources of vaccine for low- and middle-income countries are those being produced by China and India, with Russia providing smaller amounts of vaccines. This is substantiated by various press sources that recount how countries in Latin America, Eastern Europe, Africa, and Southeast Asia are receiving supplies from China, India, or Russia. How much of the vaccine supplies from Sinovac, a Beijing-based biopharmaceutical company, and Sinopharm, a Chinese state-owned company, was administered locally in China, and how much has been provided to the rest of the world? According to a 5th of April article in Nikkei Asia, which relied on data provided by Air Infinity, an analytics company, about 115 million doses of the vaccine have been used in China, and the same amount has gone to the rest of the world. Similarly, based on the figures released by India's Ministry of External Affairs website on 15th of April, more than 65 million doses of the vaccine produced by the Serum Institute Covishield vaccine licensed from AstraZeneca have been exported to other countries. With the surge in the rate of infection in India recently, The doses exported from that country have fallen in comparison with the number of vaccine doses it has administered to its own population. According to a 13th of April article in Deutsche Welle, more than 104.5 million people in India have received at least one dose of the inoculation, whilst India has shipped more than 60 million doses of the vaccine to 76 nations. China, India and Russia are the only three major countries that have been willing to export vaccines whilst also vaccinating their own populations. To curtail the sharp rise of COVID-19 cases in India, the country is currently prioritizing its supplies and has temporarily halted exports of vaccines from India. This has slowed down vaccine supplies to other countries significantly, particularly in March and April, and will impact the COVAX program, particularly in Africa, which is heavily dependent on the World Health Organization's Access to COVID-19 Tools, or ACT Accelerator Program, and its vaccine pillar of COVAX. The Sputnik V, developed by the highly respected Gamaleya National Center of Epidemiology, has shown its efficacy in clinical trials. However, ramping up its production has been slow. Russia's production capacity of vaccines is not on the same scale as Indian and Chinese manufacturers. While many Indian and South Korean companies have expressed interest in manufacturing the Sputnik V, they have yet to start doing so. Only one South Korean company, Hankook Chorus Farm, has started production of Sputnik V, and a large consortium of South Korean companies has signed up to manufacture 500 million doses. Five Indian companies, Hetero Biopharma, Gland Pharma, Stelis Biopharma, Virchow Biotech, and Panacea Biotech, have inked deals with the Russian Direct Investment Fund, or RDIF, for setting up a combined production capacity of 850 million doses. Meanwhile, even as India looks to ramp up its current vaccine production to meet the worldwide demand, it has not been able to do so. Well, dear listeners, that was the first part of an article by Prabir Purkayaswa. The piece is titled "The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level." Tune in tomorrow for the second and concluding part of this article. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
Yousafzai was born in Swat Valley, northwest Pakistan, on July 12, 1997. Her father was a teacher who cared about his children's education. That's why Malala, who was only 15, strove for women's education rights in Pakistan and blogged about it. This led the Taliban to create many problems for her. On October 9, 2012, Malala was riding the school bus home with her classmates when a group of Taliban gunmen stopped the bus and got on it. One of the men shouted, "Which one of you is Malala? Speak up, otherwise I will shoot you all."
Upon being identified, Malala was shot with a bullet in her head. She was not in a stable condition for surgery and removal of the bullet, but her condition later improved enough for her to be transferred to the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham, UK, for surgery. The surgery was successful, and the bullet was removed from her head. After recovering, on January 3, 2013, Malala was discharged from the hospital. The Taliban's attack against Malala and her injury received extensive media coverage across the world. This led to widespread support for Malala. The support led her to found an organization in Birmingham that fights for women's education rights in Pakistan. The supports for Malala continued with an invitation for her to speak at the UN General Assembly in New York. In her speech, she defended all children's right to education. She also called for a worldwide attempt against illiteracy. In another part of her speech, she emphasized that she will fight for women's rights because they are prone to suffering more than others. She also asked politicians to take the necessary measures to guarantee that all children enjoy the right to enter school. On October 10, 2013, Malala received the European Parliament's Sakharov Prize for freedom of thought. Also, Time magazine selected her the runner-up to Barack Obama as the Person of the Year in 2012. The attention and praises given to Malala made her the youngest Nobel Peace Prize laureate at the age of 17. For her struggle to improve the education levels in Pakistan, especially for Pakistani girls, she received the 2014 Nobel Peace Prize. Now, Malala is a symbol of fighting terrorism and is a well-known human rights activist in the world.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of God, the most merciful, the most beneficent, today is a day of great happiness for me. I'm humbled that the Nobel Committee has selected me for this precious award. I'm also honored to receive this award together with Kailash Satyarthi, who has been a champion for children's rights for a long time. Twice as long, in fact, than I have been alive. I'm proud that we can work together. We can work together and show the world that an Indian and a Pakistani, they can work together and achieve their goals of children's rights.
She is one of thousands of Pakistani children who are victims of terrorist attacks, war and violence in the country. Children like Nabila Rahman, who was subject to a terrorist attack only 15 days after Malala.
So that I remember waking up that morning and my grandma was calling me outside. She said, come help me, let's collect the okra. So she was teaching me how to tell the difference between an okra that is ripe and what is not ripe. And so I was holding the okra as she was picking it.
On October 24th, 2012, in North Waziristan, an 8-year-old girl called Nabila Rahman was helping her grandmother along with her brother and sisters. Nabila's grandmother, Momina Bibi, was teaching the children how to pick okra as the family prepared for the coming Eid holiday. Suddenly, the children heard a sound coming from the sky. The sound emitted by the CIA-operated drones is a familiar sound to those in the rural Pakistani villages, which are stalked by them 24 hours a day. But it was a little different this time. The US Army's drone, instead of taking pictures and surveying the life of Nabila and her family, released a number of bombs onto them. 7 children were wounded, and Nabila's grandmother was killed before her eyes. Nabila and her father, who was a teacher like Malala's father, as well as her 12-year-old brother, traveled to Washington, D.C. to seek answers about that day's attack. Despite all the obstacles, they had managed to acquire visas in order to travel to the United States. But Nabila and her family were roundly ignored. At the congressional hearing where they gave testimony, only 5 out of 430 representatives showed up. Nabila's father asked the representatives to cite the reason behind their attack so that he would understand why his innocent mother had to die, and so that he would understand why his 8-year-old daughter was attacked by the U.S. Army. He wanted the people of the United States and the world to know that his daughter was wounded because of the U.S. Army's attack. However, the U.S. Army and government did not even apologize to the family of the victims. Also, Nabila's story was never covered by the media. The U.S. authorities and even the United Nations did not react to the incident. But why is there so much difference between Malala and Nabila, two Pakistani girls who were subject to terrorist attacks within 15 days? The answer is clear. The difference relates to the attackers. The only people to be recognized for their suffering in this context are those who were killed by the United States enemy rather than by the US itself. Malala was attacked by the Taliban, and supporting her was naturally a promotion of the continuation of the US presence in Pakistan. Supporting Malala meant the necessity of the US forces' presence in the region to fight off threats such as the Taliban. She is a symbol for proving the righteousness of the United States warmongering in other countries, especially in Pakistan.
It says that you can't use these weapons unless you have near certainty that there will not be civilian casualties.
But Nabila was harmed by the U.S. Army, and supporting her and covering her story in the media meant confirmation of the U.S. Army's bloodshed in Pakistan. New America, a U.S.-based think tank, estimates the number of civilians killed in Pakistan by the United States drone strikes at around 245 to 303. This is while 414 strikes have been carried out in Pakistan so far, which means most U.S. drone strikes have killed civilians. Therefore, supporting Nabila meant showing the American forces atrocities against people. It meant the admission of war crimes and killing of innocent people by the United States, and it was a criticism against the unrestricted presence of the United States in other countries. That's why, in spite of the numerous victims of terrorist attacks and wars in Pakistan and other countries that have been invaded by the United States, we don't usually witness the same support Malala received being offered to others. Victims who, like Nabila, are never heard of. No book is written about their lives, and no prize is given to them.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant fact.
Imamat yek asl zinda dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
پیغمبر فرمود ایها الناس ان انفسکم مرهونتون به اعمالکم جانتون.
Prophet Muhammad in his Sha'baniya sermon states, O people, your soul is the captive of your deeds. This sentence of the Prophet is very important. This means that we are the captive of our desires and habits. Prophet Muhammad, in continuation of his sentence, asks us to free ourselves from the prison of deeds and desires. Now, one way is to do istighfar and repentance. The best time for repentance is the holy month of Ramadan. In the month of Ramadan, our will is stronger because Satan is chained. The holy month of Ramadan is the best chance for leaving our sins.
رمضان رحمت خدا به مو بنده، اصلا بدون بهانه میده، چه برسه اگه شما یه بهانه دست خدا بدی.
In the month of Ramadan, Allah bestows his blessings for free and without any demand. This is why the Prophet said, cruel is the one who does not make the most out of the month of Ramadan for himself. We find that this month is full of Allah's blessings, and the only way to absorb these blessings is leaving our misbehavior and misconducts. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.